So we're not actually taking, when we look at the justice system, we're not taking it in, perhaps some might say, in the order in which people who experience the justice system actually experience it. We talked about corrections in the jail system in the last panel. But we're going to double back a bit and look at the intake, I mean, how people get in to begin with, and that often begins with sentencing issues and sentencing policy. So what we're going to do now is a what we're calling sort of a super panel, divided in two. We're first going to look at the issues of sentencing itself around, primarily in the states. We'll look a little bit at the federal government. Those of you who've been following the news know there's a lot of things going on in the sentencing area, both at the federal level and at the state level. The moderator for this panel, originally scheduled on your programs, is John Gramlich. Unfortunately, an emergency called him away, but he's a very adequate substitute, is one of our speakers who was already scheduled here. It was Adam Gelb, who's the director of the Public Safety Performance Project at Pew Charitable Trusts, and to whom we're also indebted, I should add, for sponsorship of this panel. His Adam's bio is in your agenda, and he's not only has a illustrious history in looking at these issues of sentencing with Pew, but he's a former journalist himself. So I'll just leave it over to Adam behind me, and we can start. By the way, thank you very much. Adam.
Thank you, Steve. Sorry that John is not here. He did have something that called him away, and I've been thinking about what the best way to do this is, because I got a lot of stuff I would like to say. I don't want to just moderate, too. I was planning on having some things to say, so I may jump back and forth between the mic and the table. I actually won't do that. I'll try to restrain myself, but we're going to have a real interactive discussion here, and I'm going to kick right into it. Perhaps a little bit different perspective. Professor Bloomstein is still here this morning. I want to just paint a quick picture and then get the panel to respond. And that quick picture is this, that there is now broad consensus in this country that we lock too many people up for too long and that we can have a pretty significant reduction in the size of the prison population without jeopardizing public safety. But that's where we are as a country at this point. And I'd offer a couple pieces of evidence to that effect. As Professor Bloomstein painted the picture this morning, for the last 10 years or so, or at least the first 10 years of this decade, this century, this millennia, from 2000 to 2012, there was flatness, but it was still rising a little bit. The incarceration rate actually peaked in 2008 at the way we calculated it, as he mentioned this morning, and one in 100 adults behind bars, state, federal, local. That has now fallen back to 1 in 110, so a 9-10% reduction in the incarceration rate at all three levels. And I'll just say quickly, it's become increasingly important to look at all three numbers combined, sometimes as hard as that is to do, because of the fluidity that we see now between state prisons and county jails, with California being maybe the most obvious example of that with realignment. A lot of state inmates now just serving time at the local level, but several other states where this has kind of gone both ways, and even between the state and the state governments and the federal system. But if that's point one, we've had a drop of 10% in the incarceration rate, because even though the number of inmates has been relatively flat, obviously the underlying population continues to grow, we have a drop in the incarceration rate. Second thing is that we have seen a tremendous amount of change in the states. I don't know if everybody has their little checklist that we threw out on the table there, but at this point about 30 states have engaged in a process called justice reinvestment. Some have made significant sentencing and corrections changes, some less so, but many states at this point making changes to the things Steve mentioned, who goes in, how long they stay. And then the third thing is that the public has spoken loudly at the polls, but also at the ballot box, most recently again in California with Prop 47, and taking some lower-level offenses and in a pretty resounding vote saying, hey, we want to make sure that our prisons are concentrated on violent career offenders. The last way, real quick, and I'm going to kick it to the panel, is we did pass out a little sheet. It's just a little almost journalistic type compendium of some snippets from the most recent election cycle, and I hope you saw those on your chair. Nothing scientific here, and we're going to be trying to figure out if there's a way to bring some science to the question of what role did criminal justice play in the 2014 elections. But notice on there how sort of far we've come from that first example of Willie Horton to a point where now in this cycle, several candidates tried to beat up their opponents for being soft on crime in various ways, and those attacks fell flat. I won't go into the examples here, but you have the one that is maybe most glaring in the opposite direction, which is that Governor Nathan Deal in Georgia actually campaigned on being a reformer in this area. So this is a Republican governor of a southern state who is and this is not on the—I don't think this is on the sheet—but here's a guy who engaged in two rounds of reform: one criminal, one juvenile. And he, in his campaign, put out a campaign mailer and a flyer touting the reforms that he did. And then, in one of the two televised debates in this campaign, which was tight in the polls against his Democratic opponent, was Jason Carter, Jimmy Carter's grandson. And they got to the end of one of these televised debates, and nobody had, none of the reporters, questioners had asked about criminal justice reform. And he said in his closing statement, hey, no one's talked about criminal justice reform. And he took his closing statement to tout what he had done on this issue. So amazing sort of from that perspective sort of turnabout. So that's the sort of the premise I'm going to throw to the group here. Are we so tell me I'm wrong, if you'd like. Are we seeing a real change in the way the country approaches issues of crime and punishment? Nancy.
Hi, I'm Nancy Lavine. I'm with the Urban Institute, and my name is misspelled. So if you care, it's the email address is right in here. I'd love to follow up. If there's anything I'm saying that is of interest to you, just use the email address to contact me. Okay. I'm NLVIGNE. That's my Twitter handle. And then my last name is LAVIGNE. Right. Thank you. So I am. It's not on this contact list here. So
yeah.
Oh, good. Okay. Great. And it's not right here. So.
And Nancy, forgive me. I think everybody does have your bios, but does everybody?
Well, I was just going to tell them who I was. Do you want?
Okay. Why don't you do that?
You do it better than I.
No,
you'd make it sound much more glowing. And, right. I'm sorry. Okay. I am director of the Justice Policy Center at the Urban Institute. The Urban Institute is a think tank in Washington, D.C. I guess I'm kind of representing some of the work that we've been doing both on the state and the federal level. We've been doing a lot of work assessing the state reform efforts, and we're staffing the newly formed Colson Task Force on Federal Corrections Reform. So back to the question. The question is, are we seeing a change in public opinion around crime, sentencing,
corrections? We're going to start. This is a political conversation. We're going to come back to some of the policy changes, but let's start with
the politics.
Your sense of the public and elected officials is the conversation changing? Is it turn the corner? And and do you think this is a blip, or do you think that there's a sustainable change that we're seeing?
Right. I think it's a true change, and it will be sustainable, although I do think that in the U.S. we have a culture of incarcerating as many people as we can afford to. So I think that part of the sea change that we've experienced in looking differently about, you know, who really needs to be behind bars has been fiscally motivated and really took hold several years ago with the economic downturn and a lot of pressures on, you know, how to dedicate scarce resources. I think that brought on board a lot of the folks on the right side of the aisle to think differently about our incarceration policies. But I also think that there was a lot of ground softening that predated that around the concept of second chances and the Second Chance Act that followed. and that was under the leadership of George W. Bush. And so I think that there's also a sense among more conservative members of Congress and members of the public that there's a role for the concept of redemption, and that you know, it could make sense as absent the fiscal relationship between incarceration and expenditures to think about it in terms of individuals, individual lives, and the impact of incarceration on people and on families. I think there's also been an influence of folks in the faith community that are increasingly embracing alternatives to incarceration and looking at different ways to deal with people who are convicted of various forms of crime. So, you know, there's a lot that's driving public opinion and also opinions of politicians on the right. On the left, you know, they've always been kind of pro-rehabilitation, but, you know, for decades, you know, if you wanted to win elections, you weren't going to mention the R word. Now it's safe to do so again because I think the politicians got cover from folks on the right coming out in favor of reforms.
Right. Thanks, Nancy. Let's turn to Mark Early. Everybody see his bio as well. He was in the Virginia Senate and the Attorney General of Virginia and led the Justice Fellowship, which is, in fact, one of those very voices that that Nancy was just referring to.
Thanks, Adam. Let's see. Now we're on. First of all, the reason I get invited to these kinds of programs is that I was a Republican legislator and attorney general in a southern state from 1987 until 2001, who was truly tough on crime. I supported the abolition of parole, three strikes and you're out. We would have made it two if we could. Three strikes and you're out, reducing the age at which juveniles could be tried as adults from 16 to 14, truth in sentencing, prison building programs, and then I basically changed my mind about the efficacy of all of that. So I'm sort of a voice of someone who was there, am not there now, and sort of why and what does that mean. For me, the difference in perception and change came primarily as a result of how I view people who are in the criminal justice system. For most of my life, I viewed them as something other than myself, someone with whom I could not identify with, had little empathy or compassion for. After my time in politics for 10 years, I was with an organization called Prison Fellowship, and it took me into prisons across the country and across the world, literally hundreds of them. And that really changed me. If any of you have seen the movie Wilberforce, the story of William Wilberforce, the abolitionist in England, one of the most moving scenes in there is he took people whom he was trying to persuade, other legislators and dignitaries, down to the docks where the slave ships were. And the smell arrested their attention and began to change their minds. Very few legislators have been into prisons other than an official tour. But if you get a chance to go into prisons, they're not unlike nursing homes and hospitals. The smell will begin changing your mind about what these institutions are and how they work. Then as you begin to talk to the actual people who are there, at least for me, I realized there was only a few degrees separation between them and myself, between my children and some of those young people. And all of a sudden, it was a different world. So for me, that's sort of why I'm here. I'm not joking when I say this, but in a large part, I'm spending the second half of my life trying to undo what I did in the first half. It's much harder, by the way. It's hard to get rid of a government direction once you embark down that road. But I do agree with Adam, and I agree with Nancy. I do think we have a window of opportunity. We've had a window of opportunity now for about 10 years. I think that window of opportunity is going to last a while longer, although any sort of national crisis could change it. But that window of opportunity is that there is now, generally speaking, I think, a bipartisan agreement on the idea that we do over-incarcerate too many people, that the criminal justice system in many respects is a failed government program in terms of what we would like it to accomplish, And that, you know, when you get to the point, if you're a conservative, where you believe in limited government and programs having to justify themselves, if you believe in limited government and all of a sudden you really realize that over 1 in 100 people in the United States on any given day are under the direct control of the local, state, or federal government, you begin to say, hey, well, that's not a very small government idea. When you add to that the number of people that are on probation or parole, it gets really demanding. I told somebody not long ago, conservatives never really had a very organized, well-thought-out, philosophical approach to criminal justice. They were responding to an opportunity, political opportunity, in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. But now I think for many of us, at least for me, we've sort of seen where that led us, and it's a very dark place, quite frankly. The devastation that over-incarceration is wreaking on certain communities in the United States is something that our worst enemy could not do to us. We're doing it to ourselves. So I think there's an opportunity, but here's a problem. I think most of the reform is going to come at the state level. Anything. It's just the nature of the job. Now, some of them do, but by and large, they don't. You have to have in every state on both sides of the aisle champions of some of these reform ideas, whether it's getting rid of minimum mandatories, rehabilitation, reentry efforts, you know, the whole rethinking of the criminal justice system. You have to have champions, and they have to have readily accessible, off-the-shelf model legislation, model programs to work with. They don't have the time to develop them themselves. So I think sort of the next challenge is to get good programs, good legislative models into the hands of champions on both sides of the aisle and give them the kind of encouragement they need. This is a great piece, Adam, you all put together. This is a far different cry from 1988, which was the first year I was in politics, and the Willie Horton ad, right? Things have changed. When's the last time in a national presidential election you saw crime as a dominant issue? When's the last time in a governor's election? It's just not that rampant anymore. And the reason is it doesn't work. And here's a good example of why it doesn't work. But don't underestimate the people that temptation and the pressure on people who are behind in the polls to use it. Because sometimes it's the only thing left out there to use. But fortunately, it doesn't look like it's working.
Thank you, Mark. Let's turn to Mike Jacobson. I think a lot of people in the room know Mike. He was head of the probation department and the corrections department here in New York, also a budget official. You know, he ran the Vera Institute for a number of years and is now at CUNY running an institute on state and local governance. And I'd like for Mike, for among other things I'm sure you want to say, for you to talk about why you didn't hear from either Nancy or Mark anything that I heard about budget pressure here. And I say so because all of us talk with a lot of reporters all the time, and we don't often talk with the headline writers, and sometimes we're able to talk about all these other reasons why we're seeing this change. You talked about budget a little bit. But it doesn't make in the headlines. The assumption of so many people is that, boy, the only reason why as many states have undertaken some type of reform as they have, and these legislatures are taking these tough votes, is because they have to make ends meet, the state budgets have to be balanced, and so on, as this is really all budget-driven. Maybe you mentioned, but this is not what I'm hearing from the first two folks, is really the sort of core of what's driving this. So with that, Mike.
Okay, sure. First, I completely disagree with everything in it.
Yeah,
I just like to say that. I mean, there'll be times, I'm sure, when that's true. So I mean, just quickly on the first point before I address the budget, and there's no point repeating what people said. It's inarguable, I think. I mean, there's no particular debate that, you know, we're in a historical moment, that the sort of political dynamics, both at a national and state level, are completely different than they are now. There have been big changes in public opinion about crime generally, about the use of prison specifically, clearly, there's this, you know, commonality of interest at some level between the left and the right on crime folks and Newt Gingrich and Grover Nordquist and the, you know, the example of corrections for a lot of conservative folks being a, you know, sort of the pluperfect example of big government run amok. And they're correct. It is a great example of big government run amok. I don't necessarily believe OSHA and the post office is a great example of big government run amok. But clearly in corrections, there's no – I don't think there's any argument. So there is that alignment. And the politics at the state level, which is – Mark was saying, is where all the action ultimately has to happen. You know, in terms of budget, I think Adam and I probably we probably agree and disagree a little on this. I don't think there's any question that budget pressures certainly were and probably continue to be a fairly big factor. There's nothing like a nice meltdown of the global economy to sort of focus policymakers on issues they would rather not focus on. And when you have all the money in the world to do everything, you can build prisons and fund schools and pave roads and have little kids on health insurance. You know, when your revenues are going into the toilet, you know, things are on the table in a way that they weren't on the table before. So correctional reform for correctional reform's sake 10 years ago, doable. But, you know, it's when you're competing with throwing kids off health insurance or destroying a social safety net or laying off cops and firefighters, you know, the issue of correctional reform, prison downsizing becomes a little more attractive. I think, though, it's definitely true that reform in this area can never just be solely about money. Because you'll always get the pushback. If it's just about money, you'll hear some version of, well, you can't put a price on public safety, right? We're going to do what we need to do. We're going to find the money we need to find to protect our citizens, right? So it has to be more than just money. So I think budget pressures, without a doubt, I can obviously talk about this in excruciatingly detail, certainly at a state and local level are apparent. But I think, as people have said, there are other sort of philosophical issues, both in terms of big government, government overreach, the collateral harm that this does to people in their communities, a growing huge body of work that not only details the harm that's done by mass incarceration, but alternatives that are much more humane and successful. And, you know, all that stuff by osmosis kind of gets into the sort of policymaking apparatus, and then it coincides with these issues of redemption and faith-based stuff. So, I mean, I think there are a lot of issues, and budget alone will never be enough. I mean, it's in there, but it's not we probably do agree that this is not just a purely budget-driven response. It has to be more than that to get from sort of even to get from here to here. It has to be more than that to get from here to here. It can never just be a budget question.
So as we like to say, sometimes it's the budget's bringing policymakers to the table, but it's not the meal. Right. If that's a there are many metaphors, but maybe that's one of them. So what's the if there is this level of consensus at this point? Why haven't we seen more yet, or are we about to? Nancy?
Well, I'd argue we've seen an awful lot already. I think that what people want to see more of is more extensive reform. So, you know, better than I do probably how many states have engaged in state reform efforts. We profiled 17 of them in a publication last year, Assessing Justice Reinvestment. I think we count 33 or 34 who are doing that work under the guise of justice reinvestment. But there's other states. There's California. There's New York. There's plenty of other examples as well. So, you know, the question is not, you know, doing more. It's, I think, you know, going further. I think that, you know, a lot of these reform efforts have been pretty big and bold and brave, especially on the part of the legislators, many of whom became educated, just like my colleague over here did, you know, didn't come to the table like saying, I want to do reform, but kind of came to it along the way. And what we're seeing now is a slowing of growth that is quite impressive. But what I think there's an appetite for is real reductions in population. And so I think the question is, how do we get there? And is that appetite just among the types of people who were in this room, you know, the intellectual elite, or is it more widespread? And so I'm just not answering your question by just asking it in a different way. Was that at all helpful?
Mark, your thoughts, what's tapping the brake here, if you will?
Well, I think just to go back to a comment I made a minute ago, and I have a lot of admiration for state legislators, so this is not a pejorative statement, but I do think they have to be spoon-fed. Again, they're part-time. You know, in Virginia, we're probably the most extreme part-time legislature. We meet from the first week of January until the first week of March. That's it. Everybody goes back and works. And the top salary when I was there, you know, 15 years ago was, you know, if you were a legislator, you got $20,000. So it's a part-time job. Now, some people figure out how to get rich off that. I'm not sure how, but anyway, that's another story. So I do think they sort of have to be spoon-fed. And if I were sort of thinking about strategically, mechanically how to do this, I think what I would do is pull the institutions in the country together who are on the cutting edge of the research of this, you know, folks like here at John Jay, the Constitution Project, the Brennan Center, VERA, the Urban Institute, Pew, go down the line, get them together with the organizations that really do spoon-feed legislators. That's the National Conference of State Legislatures, the Council of State Governments, and ALEC. And recognizing this is a bipartisan issue because, you know, Republicans tend to feed from ALEC, Democrats tend to feed from National Conference of State Legislatures and CSG. Get these groups together in coming up with model legislation and push it hard, and push it toward the committees, specifically the people on the committees that make a difference. If you got something on the floor of the Senate or the House in any given state, it might pass, but a lot of times the harder job is getting it through the committee. And the criminal justice committees, the courts committees, can often get populated with people who tend to be much more hardcore. They tend to be more rural sometimes. So you got to find the right people, the committee chairman, and push these ideas with these people across the board.
And Nancy, do you want to jump in?
I understand the challenges that you're describing with the short sessions and the need to spoon feed, but I'm concerned about spoon-feeding model legislation, because what we've observed of successful reform is that it really has to be data-driven, and that every state has a different makeup, a different criminal code, different things driving the continued growth in the system. And so if you just, like, give them a menu and let them choose what they want to implement, it's probably not going to achieve the results that you want.
That's a good point. It would help, though. I just know from experience, you know, I wanted to do something. I knew I couldn't put it together myself. So I had to either have the savvy to reach out to somebody like a Urban Institute or a Pew or a VERA, or I would go online and look and say, well, what are these national groups? What do they have in the way of model policy? And at least I could start there, you know. So it's more of a starting point than an end product.
Well, I guess a couple of things. One, I mean, you know, one is, you know, in terms of your sort of painting this as, you know, putting the brakes on, and I think it's really important to appreciate what's happened. You know, when you go back and look at the last 45 to 50 years of incarceration growth, you know, you'll see this relatively kind of straight line going up, and then a sort of relative flatness with some marginal decrease. And as Adam said, a lot of the marginal decrease is a big national number. Within that number, you have a lot of states, New York being one, that have actually made some pretty impressive decreases. So, I mean, simply the fact that this growth curve has kind of flattened and is starting, at least in the aggregate, to go down, albeit very marginally, is something that I think, I mean, it's both impressive in its own right when you put it in historical context, and it had to happen. That said, right, it's not – That curve in the growth pattern is not going to get to where a lot of people would like to go, right? That is not going to end mass incarceration, and we can talk about what that means and try to, you know, turn it into an empirical question. But to do that, you need a second or third wave of reform that's going to be materially different. It has to be from what has happened up to now. It cannot just be about – you know, low-level mandatory minimum sentencing reform, diversion of drug offenders, diversion of mentally ill folks, successful reentry programs, parole technical violation reform, all of which, I mean, I've worked for most of my life on that stuff, all of which is hugely important. But that in and of itself will not get you the end of mass incarceration, cannot be done.
Let me ask you to stop there for a quick second. I'm going to say something and then toss it back to you. We got here maybe a little sooner than we planned, but I think it's a conversation that folks would like to hear. How many of you picked up the Mississippi brief? I was hoping a couple more folks had it, but if you could maybe even just share, because we were trying not to do slides and everything here, but pick that up real quick and notice what happens in a state when that state does do some fairly aggressive reform aimed at the lower level nonviolent offenders and parole and probation violators. So if I don't know if you can sort of hold it up and share it, but you'll notice the top line, and I'll do a little reenactment up here. So the top line, right? This is what was going to happen without reform in Mississippi, and then what you see happen is that bottom line looks a little bit like a check mark. It's a little bit of a flat check mark, but you see what happens when you take out of the system or you divert people who were going for fairly short sentences, parole and probation violators. You have this sort of, over the first couple of years, you have a fairly dramatic drop in that prison population. And I'm happy to let folks know that just in the last few days, a story in the Mississippi press. Don't we have somebody here from Mississippi? I think the population is down 3,000 inmates in Mississippi year over year. So big drop in a system of, 22,000 of, so pretty big impact from a variety of things, those reforms and others. Here are some copies of that coming around. But then what you see what happens is a flattening out over time. And you can call this prison math, or Mike, you probably have a better term for this, but then what happens, right, is that you have a large number of people who are in there for serious violent offenses, for long sentences, and you have a good number of those type of folks coming in anyway. So that impact that you see in the short term sort of gets outstripped. So I wanted to call your attention to that. I want to say one more thing and then toss it back to you guys to talk about sort of what would ending mass incarceration take and how would you even define that. And there are a number of different ways to slice these numbers, but I'll throw out just one, which is that there are 8 states that comprise 50% of the nation's prison population. So you get, you know, California, Texas, Florida, right, a couple others. So if nothing further changed in those 8 states, in order to get to a 50% cut on the prison population, the other 42 states would have to zero out their prison populations, right? This is big change. And then, right, you can just sort of play around with the numbers like this. If you had a 25%, if you got those big states to reduce their populations 25%, the other 42 states would have to still reduce theirs by something like 75% in order to get to 50%. It's very difficult math when you look at it that way. So just with that set up, I'd like to turn back to Mike to talk about, so what is mass incarceration? How would you define it? And obviously you guys as well. And what would it take?
Sure. You know, and at some level, you know, people throw these terms around all the time. I mean, as do I, you know, mass incarceration, ending mass incarceration. And, you know, so I've been struggling a little with what that, you know, I mean, ending mass incarceration is in theory a sort of quantifiable thing. Like at what point do you go from mass incarceration to just incarceration? And at one hand, that's, you know, a sort of meaning of life kind of question. On the other hand, for me, there are obviously different ways to do this. For me, what it means is if you're really going to end mass incarceration and go to a country that just has, you know, incarceration, in order of magnitude terms, the way I think about this is that, you know, for years and years, decades before the buildup of the American correctional system, we, the U.S., were at an incarceration rate of roughly about 150 per 100,000 in round numbers for years and years and years. And then we had this sort of what looked like an exorable buildup to where we are now, which is, what, about 470, 480 per 100,000 in prison. So I'm just talking about prison now. So we have a sort of historical marker in the U.S. And then if you look at the sort of Western European countries and did a blended rate, right, and they're very different, right? The Scandinavian countries are much lower. The U.K. Is much higher. But if you did a blended rate of theirs, you'd also come out to around 150 per 100,000. Again, these are sort of order of magnitude numbers. But for me, if we went back to something around 150, 160, 170, 180 per 100,000, which would put us in line with a lot of Western European countries, put us back to where we were for decades, if you think that's about right, more or less, and obviously this is an arguable point, you'd have to go from 1.4 to 5 million people we have in prison now, and you'd have to take a million people out of prison, right? You'd have to get to about 400 or 500,000, which is why, and I think at that point, again, you can argue what the number is, I think at that point, you know, you'd have an incarceration rate, but you wouldn't have mass incarceration. And, you know, my point in bringing this up before, in terms of your initial question about, is, you know, is this a moment, you know, are the politics aligned? I think there's no question they've been aligned, and certainly to the extent that the gains we've made, which again, historically are very impressive, you know, one of the questions is that enough of an alignment that you can build a political, fiscal, substantive strategy to get, you know, we've gone like this, we've gone down, but can you get from here to here? And that's, I think, a real open question because, you, as I said, you have to do much more than we've done now, and you have to get to this issue of violence. You can't start the conversation, as both a lot of conservatives and liberals and progressives do, with some version of, I mean, except for the violent offenders, you know, except for violence. You know, you just can't make that distinction. If you want to end mass incarceration, you can say we want to never touch that. We're not going there. And, well, I wouldn't say that's fine, but that's fine. And then just be honest and say then we're not going to end mass incarceration, because the only way to end mass incarceration is to put that on the table. And I think there's a variety of ways to do that, but the question is, can you get to a politics that allows you to do that? And that's obviously an open question.
Great. And, Mark, if you could pick up there and just say your circles, is ending mass incarceration actually articulated as the goal? Is that a helpful way to garner additional support to talk about it in those terms? And if so, what do you think it means to conservatives?
Yeah, I think politically, if you're talking to conservatives, that's an okay way to talk about it. I think the better way to talk about it is talk about it as a government program. How do you evaluate the success of a government program? What's its purpose? You know, recognize that any government program is going to grow if you give it oxygen. So I think it's philosophically, it's better to come that way. But there is a point at which anybody in elected office begins to realize after a while that a lot of their constituents have families in prison. You know, and so that it begins to get, it's not the other that I was talking about a little while ago. So, I'm not sure what the if you could define a healthy society. It would be interesting if you could do some research and say, we think a healthy society has this rate of incarceration. But I'd be happy to get back to where we were, you know, in the hundreds, you know, as long as we don't talk about the violent crimes. No, just kidding. But, you know, in my circles today, I'm a little removed from politics because I've been out of it now for a while. I mean, I stay involved a little bit, but not in a partisan way. It's more a policy way. My circles today are, I'm in the courtroom every day. So what I tend to see every day are the things that are inbuilt into the system that almost guarantee the failure of it. For example, I do criminal defense work. So I have a lot of clients who have a drug problem. I'm in the Northern Virginia area, Metro D.C. I have a lot of clients that have a heroin problem. I haven't had a client in the last 3 years, I think I can say that universally, maybe one, that I haven't gotten back. In other words, they're all coming back. My latest one is a young man who, well, first of all, in Virginia, if you're put on probation for any drug offense, part of your probation is that you have to be abstinent from alcohol and any other drugs. So I couldn't survive on probation. I couldn't pass a color-coded test unless I was going to completely abstain from alcohol. So I have a young man who has had a significant heroin problem, been through rehab twice. He was doing fine in terms of heroin, but he got color-coded, and he came in for positive for alcohol, and they brought him in for a violation. That sort of stuff just sets people up to fail, in my opinion. And there are a lot of those sort of things in the system. I think part of dealing with mass incarceration is deciding what's incarceration good for and what's it not good for. And then once you incarcerate someone, that's fine. But then the collateral consequences of that many times ensure they're going to be back. So you're going to have reincarceration. So I think incarceration rates not only have to do with bringing them down, not only have to do with looking at why we want to incarcerate someone in the first instance, but secondly, what is it about the collateral consequences that almost ensure somebody's going to come back, and trying to reduce those kinds of consequences? If part of their probation is they have to remain alcohol-free, even if they didn't have a drug or alcohol offense, that's just sort of ridiculous in my mind. But in the hands of the wrong probation officer, and just the wrong alignment of the stars, people are coming back for things like that. That may be an extreme example, but it's my this week example from my client.
Thank you, and appreciate your sort of steering us. I was going to probably stay on the politics and politics and policy. Thanks for steering to the policy. Nancy, I think you have something to say, but I'd like you to also add in there a little bit, building off of where Mark was, since you have done this assessment of 17 states that have done justice reinvestment-inspired reforms over the last few years. If you give a little bit of a flavor for folks of the sort of the most common kind of reforms that we've seen.
Remind me, because I did want to talk a little bit about this definition of mass incarceration. Mm-hmm. I don't know that any of us could agree on what the right definition is or threshold is from regular incarceration to mass. I certainly think that Michael's one is a reasonable one. But it relates also to these movements to, like, cut 50%. And, you know, as a researcher, that just really bugs me because, you know, why is that the magic number? It could be 60. It could be 30. We don't know until we really spend more time doing two things. One, deciding what prison is for to begin with, which is a very good point. And then, let's just take that first point. So why does prison exist? Criminology 101. Incapacitation to prevent people from committing new crimes, at least on the outside. Retribution, that's closely related because we're mad at them. We want them to pay in some way. Rehabilitation, which can sometimes happen behind bars and sometimes not. So, like, really getting a better sense of, you know, what the public thinks the purpose of incarceration is and what the legislators think it is, I think, is important because everything stems from that. So, I can't remember who referenced what I call the dirty little secret of corrections reform, and that is that there are very few nonviolent, first-time, low-level drug offenders behind bars in the state prisons. There actually are quite a number of them in the federal system, and I hope we get a chance to talk about that later. But given that there's that low-hanging fruit no longer exists, what changes? What could possibly change? How could we ever get to the point of reducing the incarceration to the extent that it's normal incarceration, as referenced by other countries? And I think that one way to do it that's going to be palatable to the public is reducing sentence lengths. I don't think we can get there by just saying, okay, you won't go to prison anymore. I think that prison lengths are really long. I don't think people give any thought to what it means to be removed from society, even for one calendar year. You're missing so much of life, of, you know, relationships with family. And, you know, in the federal system, drug offenders, their average sentence is around 14 years. 14 years. I mean, there has to be ways to reduce sentence length in a way that would ultimately have a big impact on our incarceration rate in this country. But I don't think that we're going to get to big numbers if we only try to persuade the public and legislators that fewer people need to be behind bars when you still have these serious violent offenders out there.
Let me just pick up on that real quick, and then we'll get back to where we were. We at Pew, we've done a lot of polling. For what it's worth, there's a whole part of Pew called the Pew Research Center that does polling, and projects like ours that work on specific issues do our own polling. So these are polls that we've done over the years using some of the political pollsters in the country, public opinion strategies, and the Mellman Group, and so on. And we found some pretty amazing stuff on this very question. We have of length of stay, and people seem to get what the research says here, that there's no relationship between length of stay and recidivism. They kind of understand that. They'd much rather in a number of different questions over several years now have responded to questions saying that they would rather people serve shorter amount of time behind the walls if the funding were reinvested in stronger supervision and programs to reduce recidivism. And just to this point, Mike and Nancy, about violent offenders, we did ask a question separately for violent offenders and nonviolent offenders. I just want to share the result with you really quickly. We asked, would you rather a violent offender spend 5 years who got sentenced to 5 years, spend 5 years behind the walls and then be released without supervision, or serve 4 years and be released on a year of mandatory supervision? So pretty clear choice: less time with supervision, or just serve violent offender serve the flat 5 years. And the response of over 2-1, I think it was 69-74%, something like that, approving of a shorter prison term followed by supervision. And interestingly, on a lot of these questions, and this is something you get from pollsters, you get that total number, but then you look at how many strongly agree versus what the total agree is. And the strongly agrees for a lot of these type of questions are way up in the 60-70%, which is real impressive to them that you have that kind of an intense level of support for these kind of things. The numbers were actually about the same for nonviolent offenders. We asked the same question for three years flat versus 2 years in prison plus 1 year on supervision for nonviolent offenders. I think there was margin of error actually in that case in terms of people not making a distinction between violent and nonviolent. So just quick reactions to that, Mike, or are you?
Yeah, no, that makes sense to me. And you know, part of the challenge is how you talk about this in a way where you don't sort of invite the obvious sort of toxic politics around talking about violent offenders and coddling criminals. And, you know, I mean, and Nancy's right. You have to, you must confront, which is not to say there's not stuff you can do on the front end and diversion, all that, which there is, and goes back to arrest policies as well. But you have to get to this notion of sentence lengths, and our sentence lengths are just completely on the right side of the bell curve. I mean, no one puts people in prison for as long as we do, even recognizing some of those people do really bad things. But, and this, you know, it's partly a sort of philosophical, moral, ethical question, right? How long, what's the right amount of time? And it's, you know, again, that's, you know, dancing on the head of a pin kind of question. But when you look at how long we decide to put people in, you know, we throw these numbers around, you know, like they're pennies. You know, 20 years, 30 years. I mean, other, you know, people in Western Europe and Germany and the Netherlands, even taking Scandinavia off the table, you know, put the length of time we put people in prison for 25 years, they put people in for 7 years, because there, the sort of legal and cultural context is 7 years is an incredible amount of time to be in a brutal, punitive, dehumanizing environment. It's just, and I spent a lot of my life running these places, or at least being in them. And that's not to say that some people shouldn't spend much more than that. But, you know, we've lost any sense of connecting those sort of times to the experience of essentially being a captive in, even in the best case, a, you know, incredibly unpleasant institution. And so the question is, how do you have the discussion in policy terms and political terms that's similar to that, you know, 20, especially because there's really very little. We're not talking about public safety now, right? The research on this is in. You're not going to compromise public safety by certainly making marginal decreases from 15 years, 12 years, 11 to 8, right? It's a sort of philosophical. It's a philosophical question, and as Nancy says, and she's absolutely right, you can't get to the big reductions unless you face that. And the question is how. And it is, you know, it's nice to have that kind of public opinion polling because there's clearly something there that you can work with. So it's a question of how you frame it, what your strategy is, how you work with, you know, state legislators and frame a sort of public discussion, even around crimes that most people legitimately find abhorrent, which most people will agree. In fact, you have to go to prison. But just because you have to go to prison doesn't necessarily mean you have to spend the next 45 years of your life in prison. That's a hard, but I'd say completely necessary conversation to have.
Thank you. I'd like to move to questions in a few minutes, but not first before going back to the federal question. And Mark, appreciate your perspective that the states are where the action is and where we're most likely to see movement on this, but particularly because of your involvement with Justice Fellowship and other things that you're doing. And, of course, Nancy, just having kicked off the brand new Charles Colson Task Force on Federal Corrections that Congress set up to look at this. I think some bills dropping even today on the Hill. Talk a little bit about the federal picture here. Please go ahead.
I should start by just acknowledging that I am an optimist. But I think that there's a lot of opportunity to reform the federal system. There's a lot more low-hanging fruit than you would find in the states. As I said earlier, that the dirty little secret doesn't exist in the federal system. That is, you know, when you encounter liberals at cocktail parties talking about how there's all these low-level offenders who are nonviolent first-time offenders who are incarcerated for drug offenses, they actually do exist in the federal prison system, and they exist in great numbers, and they're really driving the historical growth and the increasing costs in the federal system, and those costs are at great expense to other fiscal priorities. And the share of the BOP budget has been growing at the expense of all other DOJ priorities year after year, and it's set to continue to grow, even though we've seen a marginal decline in the overall federal prison population. So there's tremendous opportunity. There was four or five pieces of legislation in the last Congress. One just got reintroduced last week. Representatives Chaffetz and Gowdy at the helm. Most of these are being led by Republicans. They're looking at front-end changes, which would be sentencing reform. They're looking at back-end changes, reducing sentence lengths through earned credit, often through program participation. So there's a lot to work with. And then there's this new task force that is going to be following the model of state reform, which is to really look at the data and have the data drive the policy development. So I think that there's a lot of opportunity out there. I'm very hopeful.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, I defer to Nancy on this because I'm not as in tune with the federal. I will say this, though, in terms of the politics of the possibility of future change at the federal level, I actually think, and she sort of, I think, what Nancy just said affirms this in my mind, and that is I think the significant change is going to have to be led by Republicans because I think Democrats would, the Republicans would not go along if it were a Democratic-led change, and the Democrats would be too afraid it would be used against them if they had the numbers to do it without the Republicans. So sort of like, for those of you who are old enough to remember, only Nixon could have gone to China and gotten away with it. Only Bob McDonnell in Virginia could have put through a major transportation bill and raised taxes and gotten away with it. A Democrat probably could not have. Only a Republican president, I think, can actually take this ball a significant ways down the road. I don't think that's a partisan statement. I just think it's more of a reality statement. I don't think the Republicans in Congress will go along with a Democratic president taking the lead on it. They might nibble around the edges, but they just wouldn't go along with it. You'd get bogged down in gridlock.
Yeah, and you know, on a substantive level, I don't think there's any question that Nancy is correct. I mean, there's you know, whether you call it low-hanging fruit or all these nonviolent folks, clearly the room for reform at the federal level is immense. I mean, the growth in that specific population has just been ludicrous, and you know, the Bureau of Prisons just continues to eat the Department of Justice's lunch in terms of how big their budget is. You know, I think the biggest challenge at the federal level, which we've talked about here, is that the political dynamics at the state level are really very helpful for reform now, right? You have this sort of coming together at a state level of both sort of fiscal crises, drops in revenue. You know, they have no money or less than no money. You know, all the public opinion is that people are not crying for greater numbers of people going to prison or longer sentences. In fact, all the pressure at the local, at the state levels, and all the public opinions polls will show this is around health or education or the economy and taxes. It's not around prisons. And then the third thing that winds that up at the state level is, despite all that, you have to – policymakers have to keep putting more and more money into corrections, even as their population is flat, because there's a variety of reasons for that we can talk about. So you have to keep dumping money into this sent to this state function for which there's no public call to be spending more money in, while there's huge pressure to do something around health and education. And that dynamic sort of opens up all sorts of possibilities for reform at the state level, which is why you see all this ferment and reform at the state levels. There's a lot of really interesting stuff, some counterintuitive, especially in Republican-led states. That dynamic is not apparent at the federal level, right? That, you know, the Bureau in, at state levels, corrections can take up anywhere from 4 to 8, or in Michigan's case, maybe 30% of a state budget. You know, the percentage of state of the national budget that BOP takes up, and I don't know what it is, what, a trillionth of a percent? I mean, it's less than de minimis, right? So you don't have the budget pressures. You don't have the sort of politics that mitigate to reform. And so one of the things that happens is you get this insane growth at the federal level that in most states now, almost every state I can imagine, it just wouldn't be tolerated, or there'd be some movement, really serious movement, to try to get it down. So I think Nancy's right. The federal system is incredibly ripe for reform, and I think a lot of us in 10 minutes could sort of write, you know, here's what you should do, and here's who you should get out, and here's what, you know, but the sort of politics and policies to get from here to there, much more difficult at the federal level than they are at the states. The states is clearly where the action has been, and it's where the action is. I mean, it's 90% of the people in prison are in prison in states.
Thank you. It's just before we turn to questions, I'll just say quickly, it's been enormously gratifying to have been part of this work for the past several years with folks like this, the Council of State Governments, Justice Center, Vera, and others working out in the states, and for a lot of reasons. But one of them is you have this sort of sense of community, as tough and nasty as politics can be at the state level. They do have to balance their budgets, and they're willing to work not only across the aisle, but across chambers, right on the Hill. It's like the House does its thing, the Senate does its thing, and they kind of almost act like they're on separate planets. But at the state level, people, you know, really roll up their sleeves and work on this stuff together. And in, you know, 30 plus or minus states now, right, we've seen packages of reforms of varying size. But I have a life-size picture of President Obama and Mitch McConnell and John Boehner and the Chief Justice standing next to each other, right, the way that those four leaders of the three branches have in so many states, right? Very different dynamic at the federal level. But it could just be that we're on the verge of a breakthrough here. Nancy?
Well, I think it's worth noting there have been some strange bedfellows in the federal reform effort in Congress. You look at the bills that were introduced last Congress, the Smarter Sentencing Act, Dick Durbin and Mike Lee, Justice Safety Valve Act, Rand Paul and Pat Leahy, another bill sponsored by Sheldon Whitehouse and Rob Portman. So, you know, some very interesting combinations of legislators that you wouldn't expect to see partnering on this issue. So there's a little bit more of it than I think folks Definitely. Realize, that bipartisan coming
Yep.
together. And I think there's reasons why this administration, you know, has been a little bit reticent to get out in front. I think that there were reasons early on that they didn't want to go there. And that's the kind of like they get nothing from it being left of center. But then I think more recently they've realized that they can cause more harm than good, because reform really needs to be led by the Republicans. And there's a certain segment of folks on the Hill who would not sign on to something that they knew was spearheaded in any way by this administration.
Thank you. All right, you guys have been great after lunch and everything. Let's throw it open to some questions. We have a decent chunk of time here for that. We got Mike is coming right up here in the front.
Thank you. I'm Annabelle Goff. I'm from Bennington College. I want to ask a question of Mr. Jacobson and possibly of you. Speak into it more?
Yeah.
All right. It's around the question of violent crime. We tend, even today, to be talking about it as though it is one thing. Do we have any figures or possible ways of separating violent crime from one incident non-repeating? I think this is true perhaps more in women's prisons than in men's. There are repeat violent offenders, and there are people who've done one heinous thing that they are never going to do again.
Right. You know, it's an excellent question, and there's, I mean, you know, in a sort of forum like this, you have to skip over those sort of things, but correct. I mean, and some people talk about violent crime, and that encompasses, I mean, any sort of instant conviction for any of the sort of seven UCR crimes considered a violent crime. And there's violence and there's violence, as you say. There's people who sort of repeatedly commit, you know, sort of low level, I mean, the, you know, armed street robberies. And there's people who do one time, you know, I'm always amazed my grandmother didn't throw my grandfather off a balcony after, you know, 70 years of him nagging her. And had she done that, and I'm not saying she should have done it, but had she done it, she would have been done, right? I mean, she was would not be a threat to society. She, anyhow, maybe that's not a good example. But so yeah, exactly. So, yes, there are people who do one thing. There are people who lead sort of disorganized lives and do, you know, a series of violent crimes. And there's people who are convicted of violent crimes who in fact have really done something heinously violent. And there are people who are convicted of violent crimes who have been sort of accessories but a little removed, who have not. And so you know, to really comb through this, you'd have a conversation about it, you can't lump all these folks together. In fact, there's a lot of people in prison for nonviolent crimes who in fact are potentially way more violent than people who are in there for violent crime. So it's a very complicated discussion, and it should not be simplified by just, you know, there are people who are violent, people who are nonviolent, and violent conviction means you're violent. It's really complicated, and you have to find a way both to sort of disaggregate it, talk in a way that makes sense, and have people really get, which is obviously a challenge given all the challenges of making policy at the state level, this is really a very nuanced kind of variegated thing. It's not all one. You're not either violent or nonviolent, or you could be violent, but then 10 years later you're not violent. So yes, there is some data on this. I mean, you have to do a lot more work at a state level, but that kind of work to sort of parse this out is, I think, if you're going to really put violence, as I was saying, on the table, you sort of have to break it down and talk about it in ways that are intuitive and make sense to people.
Thanks, Mike. In the back, Professor Rosenfeld.
Yeah, just a quick comment. During the discussion of what is mass incarceration, what's a reasonable or realistic goal for reducing incarceration, suggestions have been made. Well, let's bring it into line with Western European experience, maybe 100 to 150 per 100,000. Let's bring it into line where we were half century ago. But I'm not certain either of those proposals would be all that appealing to many state legislatures. I think one thing that could be somewhat more appealing, could be, is the enormous variation across the U.S. in incarceration rates. Not every state is at the mean. Some, like Louisiana, are 800 per 100,000. Others, like Maine, are 148 per 100,000. And it's not just small rural states that tend to have the lower incarceration rates. Massachusetts, next door to Maine, has an incarceration rate under 200 per 100,000. Within each region, there's at least one state, other states, you know, because people like to compare within regions, one state, other states could look to as, if you will, a regional leader. So I don't think we have to go back a half century. I don't think we have to look to Western Europe. I think both arguments are appealing. But we can look at our own variation within the United States for models of how to decarcerate reasonably.
Yeah, and let me just respond to that, Rick, because I wasn't suggesting this as a strategy, right? What I'm saying is people talk, you know, and academics do all the time about ending mass incarceration, you know, and I think it's important at some level, even if you never mention that figure, even if you're not going to build a strategy in the U.S., given all the U.S. exceptionalism with let's do what Western Europe, right? I mean, that obviously is a non-starter. I just think it's important to really talk, if we're going to talk about ending mass incarceration, to have an idea about what we're talking about. That, for me, does not remotely turn into, so here's the strategy, right? I think the strategy you're talking about, and, you know, state-by-state strategies and getting closer to the mean, all that stuff makes total sense to me. I don't want what I said to be construed as, here's the strategy, let's go back from here to here, right? I mean, this is not my first rodeo. You know, I get that doesn't work, but I do think it's important for people, certainly like us, who talk about ending mass incarceration, that has to have some meaning, that it doesn't necessarily have to have the meaning, you know, people can have it, my meaning, but it can't just be an ephemeral concept. I think there should be some sense of where we want to get to, even if that number, never makes it out into public view.
Thanks, Mike. We have a question in front. One other sort of statistical point on this, very helpful for you to point out that range in what the state's incarceration rates are. I hope folks haven't lost as part of this conversation several times today, mentioning that we have this relative flatness in the overall incarceration rate. Also, don't lose the point that it's flat because you have some are going up and some are going down. It's not just that everybody's flat, right? There are a lot of states, some of which have undertaken these reforms, and Mississippi, where that's not even in these numbers yet, starting to show up now, will be down, but you still have a number of states growing. So you look at nationally, you see flatness, but don't lose the state-by-state variance. Some of the good and positive things that are happening in some states and some states that are really still struggling to get a handle on this up here.
Hi, thank you. Penny Dickerson with the Florida Courier. My question has this great big old setup, because I didn't think that I was as interested in, not that I wasn't interested, but I was as interested in the panel discussion with you all, as the more you spoke, the more you talked, the more I became piqued in interest, because you each kept saying the people who are in jail, the people who are in prison, the people. Would you not agree, because I have, it's a two-part question, would you not agree, and I'm going to limit it to or direct it to my state of Florida, that the black male is the highest demographic that's populating the prison system and is the greatest inmate who would and population of inmate who would benefit from eliminating mass incarceration? With that, I would like to know, and then also I wanted to say, in Florida, we have minimum mandatories like 10-20 life. That is something that's a state, and it's completely against the black male prisoner, well, actually anyone, as in the case of Marissa Alexander. Because of that 10-20 life, you had a female who committed a crime and was facing 60 years in prison. She was a mother, had a master's degree, if you're familiar with the case. So with the Urban Institute and with the Pew Charitable Trust, this is the question that's finally coming, do you give any thought to your research of how the prison system is systemically disintegrating the value of the African-American family? There's not a male, black male in the household. It's attributing to poverty. It's attributing to value systems. And it's almost lessening the value of the African-American family. Do you research that at all?
Yeah, we do and we will, but it's we're looking at it more even more comprehensively than that. We are partnered with friends here at John Jay and at Yale and at Harvard to launch the National Initiative on Community Trust, and that is an effort to build greater trust between marginalized communities that are often the ones that are experiencing mass incarceration most severely. They're the communities where, you know, just ridiculous percentages of the black males, dads, husbands, breadwinners are incarcerated. Those relationships, not just with police, but with the government and systems altogether. So when I think about issues of mass incarceration and how they affect black males and how they affect the communities in which they reside, I'm also thinking about the front end and, you know, the initial interaction with police and how they, you know, they're getting arrested at higher rates. I'm thinking about the very back end where when, you know, even when they get back out, they're under supervision and we hear, you know, how often they fail on supervision, often for, you know, very, you know, little offenses, but, you know, violations of conditions and just the larger justice system in this country, which is just sweeping up more and more people, but disproportionately black men. And then I think back to the question that you raised earlier about this issue of gun carrying. And, you know, we have these weapons often enhancements in our criminal codes by that are just triggered by possession of a gun when someone is arrested for any crime. And you have a lot of young black men and even boys who are carrying because they feel like they have to. They might not be hardened criminals, but they're getting caught up in the system as well. So, sorry, I feel like all of a sudden I'm on a soapbox. Yes, Urban cares deeply about these issues, and we are exploring them.
Thank you so much.
In the back.
Okay. Good evening. Derek Zimmerman, John Jay College. In attempting to alleviate the problem of mass incarceration, how do we address the blowback from entities that benefit from it, such as private prison corporations, contractors of those private prison corporations, subcontractors, employees of both of these entities, legislators who may house these companies and the employees, and who also get a census boost from people being in the prisons, and campaign officials who think that Willie Horton tactics may still work?
Well, so, you know, there's all sorts of obstacles to sort of correctional reform, and you've noted some of them, right? The, you know, the private corrections, introducing private capital into, the, you know, this kind of public business has obviously created an obstacle. You know, the one you didn't talk about so much, which in some ways is the one of the more powerful obstacles, is – you know, there's all the usual sort of Republican, that Democratic politics, which we've been saying are sort of blending together now. But huge, you know, the politics around prison reform in most states is an upstate downstate dynamic, right? It's less Republican Democrats than how people in cities feel versus people in rural areas where the prisons are, right? Prisons, even though there's a fair amount of literature saying prisons are not a particularly effective form of economic development, that's how a lot of rural counties see them. They think they're sort of essential. They fight for them like cities fight for Olympics, right? And so you have public employee unions who have the same sort of incentives, you know, the correctional CC away in California has had a long history of that. So there's all sorts of obstacles to sort of recover here. And so the trick, I guess, which has been mastered in a lot of states, is to develop political strategies that at least neutralize or trump those, right? Those are always going to be the case, right? The, you know, private prison folks are going to fight for market share. That's what they do. You just need to make it more important for state governments to want to downsize prisons for all sorts of reasons that trump, you know, investing in longer sentences so these places can make money. So I think, I mean, any successful strategy has to take into account what I don't particularly like the phrase prison industrial complex, but people sort of get what it means, right? There are a whole host of structural factors where people benefit either directly or indirectly from mass incarceration. They're not going to go away. You just have to be very sort of sober about the fact that they exist, especially the upstate downstate politics, and do strategies that can sort of take them on. So I think they're real. I would not say they're dispositive. They are not strong enough in the end, I think, to keep reform from happening if you do a really good job. But no question as you're raising, those are all obstacles to doing what people up here are talking about.
My name is Chase Madar. I'm a freelance journalist. I have a question for Nancy Lavinia and Michael Jacobson. There's a guy who teaches criminal law a few blocks from here at Fordham Law School, John Path, who has a provocative theory that the huge spike in incarceration in our country has less to do with the war on drugs and less to do even with harsher sentences and more to do with more aggressive prosecutions and changes in prosecutorial behavior. What do you guys make of this? Do you think he's right? If he's wrong, where is he wrong? Where is he right?
I can't say I've researched that, and I don't know anyone who has, but I will say that I think it's a valid observation that prosecutors are driving a lot of this, and it's really difficult to study their behavior because so much happens kind of behind the scenes. But I think it's fair to say that you don't see the number of prosecutors diminishing when, for example, we see the crime rate plummet. So they have to be finding new cases, and they're probably likely digging, you know, deeper and deeper to lower and lower level offenses in the process.
Go ahead, Mark.
Just one comment on this, just from personal experience. When I started practicing law in 1982, there were no, unless the police specifically asked for it. Now, in every jurisdiction in Virginia, except for maybe a few, all misdemeanor cases have prosecutors assigned to them if there is defense counsel representing the individual, which ends up – well, I'll just leave it at that. But that's a very significant change in prosecutorial strategy, and that is 30 years ago it was, we'll leave the misdemeanor stuff to the cops on the beat. We'll let them sort of deal with it with the judge. But now, you know, they get involved. Part of that has had to do with – how DUIs have been treated differently. They're misdemeanors, but they're significant political issues. So, but that's one big change. And I also think even though with most elected officials, the issue of being soft on crime now is not a particularly potent issue, with prosecutors who are elected, it still is. How are you going to run against a prosecutor if you're a challenger? You're going to accuse them of dropping the ball on some case or on being, you know, soft on some type of cases. So there's a clear default in my observation in political offices to always ask the judge for the high end of whether it's a sentencing guideline or on a bond hearing to always oppose it. And to let the judge make the tough decision rather than trying to come up with something that's, you know, arguably just and fair.
I want to bring in the Milwaukee County District Attorney here to not necessarily speak on behalf of prosecutors, but to put you on the spot here. But also just to say very quickly that I want to make sure that we hit Professor Bloomstein and maybe others here, right? Because in his talk this morning, he talked about the two levers of the prison population, one being admissions and one length of stay, and he's done a tremendous amount of work on identifying what has driven the population up. But first,
Mr. Chisholm. Adam, just to directly answer your question, of course, you know, all of the discretion in the system, whether it's the federal system or the state and local systems, it's all been driven to prosecutors. It's not because there's too many prosecutors. I would certainly make the argument that's the exact opposite. You go to any jurisdiction in the country, prosecutors' offices are generally grossly understaffed. What you're dealing with is an enormously complicated system in which the prosecutors have become the de facto gatekeepers at all levels. And so, you know, I took over for my predecessor, had been in the job for 40 years. I keep the statute book he had from 1968 when he was elected. It's this big. The criminal code is this big. The criminal code that we deal with now, and that means we do children need a protective service, termination of parental rights, delinquencies, all of the adult, you know, we do chapter what we call 980s are the commitment of sexually violent offenders. All of those cases now are extraordinarily complicated. You have to have experts in DNA. You have to have experts in sexual assault sensitive crimes. We have specialized domestic violence units. We have community prosecutors that are focused on proactive strategies. It's an enormously complicated endeavor for prosecutors, and but there's no question. We're the ones that ultimately have to, I think, take on some of the political risk and do it in a collaborative way, and hopefully do it in a thoughtful way. So you do it in a way that you're acting in conjunction with other system actors, and you're doing it in a measured way. That's why, you know, it's helpful to be part of processes like this, because the criminal justice system is not driven by scientific principles. But we can learn a lot. We can learn a lot through pairing with academics and measuring what we do to see what really works and what does not work, so we're not driven by our perceptions of what we think works versus what really does work.
Thank you. Professor Bloomstein, did you have anything you wanted to add on this?
First, I think it's very tough to separate what the prosecutors are doing from what the judges are doing, from what the parole people are doing. There's no question they are an important force, have been an important force in building the desire to be tougher, and in part because that serves their particular needs. But I think it's really across the system, and my sense is that the prosecutors, as the public becomes more aware of the desirability of bringing rationality and sensibility into the process, that the prosecutors will start to see that as part of their own interests also.
Great. Thank you. Just we had a point up here in front, if we can get the mic down here real quick. Are you on this point?
Yeah.
Okay, let me go to him first. I just want to quickly say to the fellows in the room, since you're interested in this this question, please take a look at I guess you could just Google Pew Time Served Report. A couple years ago, we did the only state by state look at how time served has increased. We looked at the change from 1990 through 2009. Found there's a 36% increase. The average actual time served went from 2.1 to 2.9 years, and was similar for similar percent increases for violent offenders and drug offenders. Property offenders had a little bit less increased time served, but there's a breakdown in how that changed over time on a state-by-state basis, and actually a breakdown to this question of how much was a change due to change in sentence length, which is significantly indicative, obviously, of prosecutor behavior and plea bargaining, and then how much was due to increased percent of sentence served, which is right more of a parole board function. So actually on a state-by-state basis breaks that down as well. Question here.
Hi, I'm Mike. I'm one of the fellows here. So this may sound naive, but we talk a lot about how people can't get elected if they're perceived as soft on crime, but also we've been talking about this, at least the beginnings of a paradigm shift in how people at all levels from, you know, the citizenry all the way up through the highest places in government are starting to rethink crime and punishment and criminal justice. So is there going to be a certain point when people are going to run on campaigns of being not soft on crime necessarily, but sensible on crime? Like, why is it just assumed that you can't be sensible on crime and sort of puff your chest out about it and get elected as a result? Yeah. Is that, am I just completely naive in asking that? Or?
No, listen, I'll turn to the panel real quick, but do remember right from the top of our the top of this session that Governor Deal in Georgia really thought he was in a tight race here, running against Jimmy Carter's grandson. The polls were a single-digit separation, I think low single digits, and into the final weeks of the campaign did exactly what you're suggesting. Glossy campaign mailer went out to the community touting the reforms that he did, and then voluntarily used the closing statement of his one of his two televised debates to bring up this subject that he wanted people to know that he had done something about. So I think we'll probably see some more of that, but we certainly, and my guess is he certainly did win, and by more than the, that's helpful piece of information to throw in there, by more than the margin of polls did. I don't think we've seen the last attack ad either, it's a fascinating question to see how that plays out. I think it's certainly in political classes and among political consultants, there's probably a pretty significant lag here in terms of where the public is on this issue versus what those consultants are talking to candidates about what they might be able to use as a wedge or a hammer against particular candidates. Thoughts of Mark? Mr. Early,
I don't think I have anything. I don't really have anything to add other than I think, you know, it's we've probably arrived when it's simply not an issue at all. I mean, not so much that you run on being sensible on crime, but that you're running on other issues, you know, water, education, transportation. You know, smart politicians recognize that on issues like this, sometimes it's better just to communicate quietly to the people who are interested in it. You know, it's not what you're out there running ads on or, you know, hitting your opponent on. So I think for me, it's a clear enough indication that you've made significant progress when this is not the issue that candidates are leading with thinking it's going to get them elected or trying to tear down their opponent on.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Question up front here.
Can I go?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Hey. Raheem, a fellow from California. I'll make this quick. Looking at mass incarceration rates and what could potentially put a dent in them, have any of you looked at to what degree the juvenile justice system later feeds the adult systems and whether reforms there are happening or need to happen, say with like status offenses for truancy and delinquency, things like that?
The juvenile justice system is a big feeder of the adult justice system, and it's sort of a unfortunate natural path in some ways. And you see on the juvenile justice side, there are some places, I guess California is the most notable one, that have reduced their sort of incarcerated juvenile population by whatever the figures are, at least at a state level, by 90%. But there's no question that graduates from all sorts of institutions, whether it's juvenile justice or people aging out of foster care, those are sort of feeders for the prison system. And so, ultimately you want to do reforms way further down than at the sentencing stage, right? The goal is to get people, not to get people coming in the first place. And so there's a fair amount of research on the juvenile system about what can keep people from sort of getting from juvenile to adult. And so again, if you're really going to have a strategy to sort of reduce or, end or, significantly impact mass incarceration, it's not going to be one thing, right? It's going to be all these things are ultimately related to mass incarceration and people who age out or fail in the juvenile justice system more often than not will appear in the adult system.
Let me just add real quickly, if you do think about sort of ending mass incarceration from a 50% cut or whatever your sensibility is about that, please notice that the juvenile commitment rate, which is the juvenile incarceration rate essentially, is down 50% now from its peak in the late 90s. And also note that one of the reasons that can happen is that the juvenile, is the math is very different, right? In the juvenile system, kids who are going to be locked up, basically are going to be locked up if they're 15, 16 years old, maybe some 14-year-old, maybe some 17-year-olds, but they're only there for a short period of time. And so they can't have 25-year-long sentences and stack and stack and stack in the system. And so that's one of the reasons why that juvenile rate has come down more or less in tandem with the rate of juvenile violent crime, as I think folks here at John Jay have well documented and put out. So it's a very different mathematical and systemic dynamic. But note that it's way down.
So I'm a public health professional working in a criminal justice system. And I wrote a book a number of years ago called The Plague of Prisons, The Epidemiology of Mass Incarceration. And it wasn't a metaphor, because to my eyes, a lot of what was going on looked like an epidemic. So take something everyone agrees is an epidemic, like Ebola. I've worked in Africa on HIV. And in Ebola, it turns out it's very important what people do locally about it, with the dead body in their room or their sick family member. Not the only thing that mattered. Outside help certainly helped. But the structure of the epidemic was such as what you did with each case was very important, and you had a window to do that in. So imagine this isn't a room full of academics and officials of various kinds, but a room in one of the million-dollar blocks of New York where everybody goes to prison, and full of black faces of people who have – everyone has someone in prison in those groups, if you ask people to raise their hands. And you were being asked the same kinds of questions. How would you answer them there if someone said, okay, but what can we do here in the neighborhood that's affected by this? What can we do to stop mass incarceration? What would you say for that?
So, you know, there's – I mean, for people, for at least the sort of academics in the room, right? And a couple of people, I guess Todd Clear is the one who comes to mind, has written about this quite a bit, about neighborhoods where it sort of hit a tipping point when enough of the people in the neighborhood go to prison. I'm leading up to a discussion that in theory, and actually I've talked to Todd for a long time about how you have this discussion. So you have these neighborhoods where you have this huge transfer of people out of the neighborhoods into upstate prisons, right? And so when you look at a neighborhood in the New York context, whether it's Bushwick, East New York, we taxpayers are spending really hundreds of millions of dollars on residents of those neighborhoods. We're just not spending any of it in those neighborhoods, right? We spend it on people who live in those neighborhoods, but then go wherever, upstate. So a discussion you could imagine starting to have with those communities is what would you suggest, right? You have, you know, in this particular neighborhood, you have 5,000, and they're mostly going to be young men of color, right? Doing, you know, stuff from nonviolent crimes to violent crimes, whatever that means, going up. What could you think about if we're spending, you know, $250 million a year of residents in your neighborhoods? What kind of discussion could we have with the neighborhood? And that's always a difficult concept, about spending some of that money in the neighborhood, right? The trade-off being not everyone's going to go to prison, right? What could we do for the neighborhood that would both keep people from going to prison and that the neighborhood felt? Because, you know, there were some of those people for those neighborhoods, they are perfectly happy for those folks to go upstate, right? There are sort of, you know, the incredibly repeat violent sociopathic folks, you know, they're happy to have them go. There are a lot of others who they're our sons and daughters. They are, but for the grace of God, go I. We over-incarcerate people. So I think you can have a discussion about what government could do with a completely different kind of use of resources that could go into neighborhoods that neighborhoods could decide in some utopian world about how resources could be used without sending people to prison, right? And that's not – I don't think it's such a utopian thought, but that's a very – I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on how you – structure a conversation like that, both with people, you know, with civil society folks and groups in neighborhoods, and how government can start thinking about using some of that money in a very different way. I think it's a real conversation, but it's also a little theoretical at the same time.
Steve, do we have time for one more, or are we...
A very quick one.
A quick one to you. You mentioned your polls. So my question, going back to Jerry, I think he is right saying you can find all the answers within the United States, looking to the fact that in Maine or in Vermont or in other states, you don't have mass incarceration. So does that relate to your polls, that there is a lower level of punitivity? Do your polls tell us that we have large discrepancy in punitive attitudes compared Vermont against Texas?
Almost no regional differences in these things. Party affiliation differences, almost no differences between members of families where it's a law enforcement household, very high levels of support for reform among households where somebody is a victim of a violent crime or a victim of a nonviolent crime. Pretty astonishing levels of support for both the concepts of sort of this general notion of shifting lower level nonviolent offenders from prison to effective alternatives, and a lot of support for specific policies to do that, like we were talking about, that mandatory supervision option. So thank you all. I want to thank the panel, and especially you all with great engagement.
This actually is one of our a great panel, because it wasn't just our panelists who were involved in it, but all of you. It was sort of a mass panel discussion, and I want to particularly thank Adam for leading it. It was really well done, Adam, so thanks. So we want to move very quickly into our next session, which begins momentarily. So if I could ask you to stand up and stretch, maybe for 4.5 minutes, and then sit down again, and we'll start our next one. So please don't leave the room unless you really have to, because we're going to start on time to try to get us through.